This is the current federal tax developments for the week of March the 12th, 2018. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by Kaplan Professional Education and your state society of CPAs. I'm Ed Zollers, and I'll be looking at a few developments that have taken place during the week in taxes as we keep moving our way through tax season. One of the things we knew was coming was changes to the various inflation-adjusted numbers that the IRS had published back in 2017. Largely because we knew that those numbers had been changed by the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. Tax Cuts and Jobs Act had changed the method that the IRS uses for calculating inflation-adjusted numbers, switching over to the change CPI, and the law also simply changed certain numbers that previously had been inflation-adjusted. So the IRS now has released on Revenue Procedure 2018-18, that was found in Internal Revenue Bulletin 2018-10, issued on March the 5th, updated numbers. What was interesting about this is this revenue procedure appears to have first been published in the Internal Revenue Bulletin, did not in the original be released by the IRS prior to publication in the IRB. That's kind of unusual. I don't know if this signals a change the service will be making in the future or whether this was a one-time only thing to get it out there and official, assuming that apparently some people, you know, may wait for the IRB to count it as official. Not sure, but nevertheless, it's there. The thing to take away from this is Revenue Procedure 2017-37 had the numbers in it for 2018. This simply changes the numbers that are not the same. So how you have to work with this particular table is to take a look at what's here, and you're going to find things that are changed from where they were in the previous RevProc. Some of the things we were interested in, though, was with what Congress did with changing the estate tax basic exclusion amount. Remember, they said we went back to 2010, doubled it. Then we changed our inflation adjusting figure. And remember that that particular inflation adjustment has various levels you have to get over before they adjust again. So there was a lot of speculation as to what the impact would be of the combination of starting with a bigger number, but not changing your level at which we change, level at which we kick in the new numbers, and going to the change CPI calculation. But what we discovered was we ended up with a basic exclusion amount for 2018 of $11,180,000. That's slightly less than twice of what would be in the original $5,600,000 doubled, which would have been $11,200,000. So if your client was looking to use up their entire lifetime exclusion amount with one major gift, now you know that number is $11,180,000. That's what you have to use up at this point in time. Other numbers were changed. One that's gotten some notice is that HSA contributions were changed. We have a different number there, a little bit reduced. The maximum health savings account contribution for 2018 for self-only plans is $3,450. The maximum for family plans will now be $6,850. For the insurance itself, the high deductible health premium minimums have to be $1,350 for a single individual, $2,700 for a family. Now, this particular document, as we say, it has a lot of detailed numbers in it, nothing much. So if you go look for it in our publication this week, you're not going to find it because we didn't write up a special rule for this. Rather, go back to that copy of the Internal Revenue Bulletin on the IRS website. That's Internal Revenue Bulletin 2018-10, RevProc 2018-18, and you'll find all the various numbers that have been changed. So if you're looking for specific items, that's the place to go look. With that, let's go on to the cases and items that we do have articles on. And the first development this week we're going to have an article on is Notice 2018-12. This notice was issued on March 5th, and it dealt with an interesting problem that the IRS has had to deal with. That is, some states have modified their law to require if you issue a health insurance policy in that state, you must provide no-cost coverage of male sterilization or contraception on your policies, or you can't sell in the state. That's fine. States can do that, and states have done it. But the question becomes, remember, we have strict rules for a high-deductible health plan. And those are the plans that we have in order for us to be able to make a contribution to a health savings account. Generally, on a high-deductible health plan, the policy cannot provide a benefit to the participant until such time as you've gone over your deductible for the year. There is a special set of exceptions in there for various items, one of which is preventive care. And the preventive care exception has been expanded to cover under the, you know, as part of the Affordable Care Act's regulation, the provision, because the ACA required this, essentially the provision of contraceptive and sterilization benefits to women. So states have now said, well, you've got to provide that to men as well. Well, the IRS said, unfortunately, this is a federal definition. And there's no current federal rule, regulation, that allows you to treat male sterilization and contraception as preventive care for purposes of the HDHP qualifying amount. So they're saying under the law as currently written, this would, if a policy offered this benefit, it could not be a high deductible health plan. That's a problem because a number of states, as we said, have required it. Tax analysts, in fact, suggested that four states that have adopted it so far, California, Illinois, Maryland, and Vermont. And they noted that only Vermont has written a special exclusion that says if a policy is to qualify as a high deductible health plan, it doesn't have to offer the benefit. The other three states I mentioned do not have that exclusion. Well, what it means is effectively under this rule, you could not really contribute to a health savings account if you're in California, Illinois, or Maryland, because your health insurance policy is going to end up covering something that it's not allowed to cover before you have paid your minimum deductible. Because of that, the IRS recognizes that obviously people have already signed up for these policies, people have already started making contributions, and you know, these are state laws that may not be able to be easily changed until next year, depending upon what the legislatures have done, their status of their session. We may already be by, as we are like in the state of Arizona, by the date when you can actually submit a bill for the legislature. Now, there are ways to get around that for those of you who know how to work it in Arizona. But, you know, you would do basically what's called a striker. You would take a bill already introduced and adopt an amendment to strike everything in the bill and substitute what you want. There are ways to get this done, but still, it'd be difficult at this late day to do it in Arizona. Arizona doesn't need this fixed, but same basic problem. So because of that, they're going to delay enforcement on this until 2020. That would allow a state legislature to go in 2019 to adopt a rule that would, like Vermont, allow a carve out for a plan that's meant to be a high deductible health plan. And then it would allow the insurance companies to begin offering that plan in 2020. Obviously, they're going to have to offer plans in 2019, you know, that offer this coverage because the legislatures won't meet until 2019. So they're going to give you some time to fix this up. Nevertheless, if you're in an affected state or your state adopts a rule like this, it's important to remember that the IRS position is it doesn't matter that the state requires it. The state law doesn't control this. Federal law does. But the IRS did, interestingly enough, offer a bit of a secondary solution that may arise. They did state that they are taking comments on whether they should make changes to the definition of preventive care and whether other things maybe should be in there. So obviously a second way this could be fixed before 2020 is if the IRS decided to expand the definition of preventive care to include male sterilization contraception. Well, let's go to court cases now. That'll be what we'll talk about for the rest of today's session. And we're going to start with a case called Mazzei versus Commissioner. This is a published tax court decision, 150 TC number 7. It was issued on March 6th of 2018. What's interesting about this case is that the tax court in this case is working around a decision of the Sixth Circuit in the case of Summa Holdings versus Commissioner, or maybe in the view of the tax court, they're not. But here's the catch. Summa Holdings involved what I tend to refer to as a Roth IRA stuffer transaction. That is a way of making a contribution of something to an IRA, an entity that you have control over, that you could then have earned lots of income and that would pay that income out to the Roth IRA, therefore taking a very minor initial contribution and turning into hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of income flowing to the Roth IRA. In Summa Holdings, the tax court had struck down a situation like that that involved that had involved a transaction that was involved with a domestic international sales corporation, a DISC. Now we have somebody coming back with a very similar transaction, but this being a foreign sales corporation. Those of you may remember, we've gone through various iterations where Congress has tried to encourage basically people to set up things that would encourage exports. They've been knocked down by, you know, by basically the World Trade Organization multiple times. So we have multiple variants, and the variant when this was put together was the foreign sales company. So we have this particular foreign sales corporation. So that FSC. In this case, what they did, the taxpayers that controlled a company in this case formed Roth IRAs. They got their own Roth IRAs. And with $500 from the Roth IRA from the two shareholders, they established a brand new corporation that was to be treated as a foreign sales corporation under the then in place law. Now, the interesting thing about a foreign sales corporation is that a foreign sales corporation has certain exceptions from the Section 482 limitations about payments between related organizations. And subject to certain limitations, the company that is selling, you know, that basically this manufacturing company is manufacturing an item to sell it into a foreign country can pay a portion of, or, you know, can pay basically a commission to the foreign sales corporation for the sales to that foreign country. And it can do so even if the foreign sales corporation actually did nothing with regard to the sales. So these taxpayers managed to do that. They set this up. So the $500 established the foreign sales corporation. They set up the FSC essentially with the with their organization, and they paid over the time frame monies that it was subject to a lower tax rate inside the corporation, and then it came out as dividends of over $500,000 worth of dividends into the Roth IRA via this vehicle. So they only put $500 in. We have $500,000 sitting in the Roth IRAs over a few years. The IRS cried foul and said that can't work. Now, in Summa Holdings, the tax court had ruled that, oh, no, it can't work. Obviously, there's no reality here, and this can't really be the way it's supposed to work, so we're going to knock it down. The Sixth Circuit overruled on the issue of, and it's interesting, the court points this out, the Sixth Circuit was only hearing the appeal of the corporation that paid money to the Domestic International Sales Corporation. And the IRS had, in essence, the tax court had disallowed that deduction in addition to saying that then this was excess contributions into the Roth IRA. Well, due to the quirky nature of that case, the shareholders actually live in different circuits, and the corporation is in the Sixth. So the Sixth only dealt with the corporation. The Sixth Circuit said, though, clearly Congress had intended this law to work this way. They had exempted them from all these related party rules. And IRS, you know, you're going too far. And tax court, you went too far. Now we've got this coming back in, essentially the same structure, this time using a foreign sales corporation. What the tax court did in this case was, and they claim that because Summa Holdings only looked at the issue of whether payments to the FS, payments to the DISC were deductible, they're saying, well, we're not saying there's not a foreign sales corporation. We're not saying that the payments from the manufacturer to the FSC are not deductible. They're perfectly deductible. They're fine. But they're saying, here's the problem. The $500 that went into this, they said that really had no relation whatsoever to the foreign sales corporation. And that in reality, no reasonable third party would have ever bought shares in that FSC unless they could control the manufacturer. So they're saying, so the Roth IRA is not really the owner of the foreign sales corporation. Rather, the real owner and the real people in control are the individual beneficiaries because of their control to manufacturer. And because of that, since they're the real control behind this, they're really the owner of the foreign sales corporation stock. And so because of that, this represents dividends to them that are then contributed to the Roth IRA, resulting in a rather severe amount of excess contributions to the Roth IRA. What will be interesting is to see, at A, will the taxpayer appeal this? Seems like it's a likely chance it will. This particular case would be go to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. We'll then have the issue of the Ninth Circuit deciding, A, you know, is this really a different situation than Sum of Holdings and what the Sixth Circuit came to conclusion there? In essence, does it matter that Congress intended this, intended FSCs to work this way? And secondly, is the real question here who owns the corporate stock? And then secondly, they would also, let's say they assume, saying, you know, tax court, this is a little weird the way you divided this up. They could still come back and say, but we think the Sixth Circuit is dead wrong. We think that this structure simply has no realistic economic substance. And because of that, we're not going to allow it to happen, even if the Roth IRA owns the stock. We'll see how the Ninth Circuit reacts, assuming that they appeal this. But keep your eyes on this case. And by the way, as the tax court points out, Sum of Holdings is actually going to trial for the individual shareholders and holders of the Roth IRAs in their circuit. So you may want to watch there and see if those courts go along with the tax court's view that, well, okay, it's all fine and good. The deduction was fine. We have no problems with that from the Sixth Circuit. But, you know, we have problems with the idea that this wasn't really owned by the IRA. We're going to agree with the tax court in Mazzei. So in any event, keep your eyes on that one. Now, next up, we're going to have what's basically a tale of two landlords. So we're going to have two separate cases that came out this week, 2 days apart. And these cases both involve taxpayers who claim to be real estate pros. The first case is Pormazi versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2018-26. It was issued on March 8th. The key interesting thing here to look at is these cases are going to both turn on the quality of the records of the taxpayer and the plausibility of their story for being a real estate professional. On paper, Pormazi, and I'm sure I'm mispronouncing this poor woman's name, so I will apologize to her now, they had far more rental properties than the other taxpayer. In this case, they had 5 rental properties, and including a fourplex. As we'll discuss in the next case, that taxpayer only had a fourplex. So they had 5 different pieces of property, one of them in San Jose. Then they had a condominium in San Diego. They had a single-family residence in Tucson, a single-family condominium in the state of Washington, and a single-family residence in Discovery Bay, California. They claimed to be real estate pros and deducted significant losses related to that. And we claim that Mrs. Pormazi was the real estate pro, so now we're looking at her activities. One real problem we get right away is we find out instantly that they did not maintain any sort of log or calendar of the work performed during those years on the property. It was likely one of those issues where they said, well, we're supposed to have spent 750 hours. Well, you know, yeah, I must do that, she decided. So therefore, I'm a real estate pro. Because the two tests are more than one half of the time she spends in material participation activities has to be in real property trade or businesses. And nobody's disputing that that would be true because, you know, in this case, they never mentioned that Mrs. Pormazi was involved in any other material participation activity except for the real estate. But then the second requirement is that she has to spend more than 750 hours in the real estate. Well, problem is they came up for exam and no calendars was going to be a problem. So what they did was they went up and they reconstructed calendars. They created brand new reconstructed calendars. And they also testified at trial about additional time that she believes she spent. Now, as the court pointed out, their position essentially was on the basis of those calendars that she spent 790 and 949 hours during those years at the San Jose property, doing various things, routine cleaning, gardening, bill paying, and surveillance. They also proposed that she spent 15 to 20 hours a week at the San Jose property carrying out those tasks. And they proposed on other basis that she spent like 275 hours and 178 hours at the San Diego property doing general things. And, you know, then she said she spent 2 or 3 hours per month or year manage over the year managing the Tucson property. And they said, well, Discovery Bay, she spent some hours there. You know, they said whatever it was. And they proposed, therefore, that she spent in total 1,127 hours in 2010 or in 2011 and 1,064 hours in 2010 on these properties. But it turns out there were some problems with the calendar. The court noted first, the calendar has entries for every Saturday and Sunday in 2010 other than Halloween and Christmas Day. Saturday and Sundays were very uniform. They didn't, without identifying a location, they said weekly cleaning and repairing, it always ran from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. and from 10 a.m. on Saturday and 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. on Sunday. Okay. There were occasional entries for time in San Diego. There were twice as month for a midweek security surveillance that was uniformly from 8 to 10 p.m. And there were a bunch of other entries, right? Doesn't tell who did each task, and they were both involved. And remember, we need her. 2011, they have a similar number of calendars. They show these things. Now, here's where some problems come in, though. The IRS took a look at their Wells Fargo bank statement, and they were using their debit card. So they found out that, in essence, they purchased food and lodging on April 28th and 29th in London Eagland and at Heathrow Airport, days they were supposedly doing work on the rentals. They also spent time during that time at taking, you know, at doing some work there. At other unspecified properties, like for August 2011, they showed they bought food in Dallas, Texas. Again, they were supposedly at the rentals. We had other issues where they were in Philadelphia when they were supposedly working on the rentals. That also didn't work very well. So what we ended up finding here with the taxpayers are that basically we just don't have very good records. The court also didn't find it very believable that they spent all that much time, you know, doing these things, that they spent all that time in San Jose doing this work when they had no tools or equipment there and had no office there. So the court simply found that, you know what, we're not buying these hours. We decide that you have failed to prove that you are a real estate professional. And that's not, you know, that's not going to work for you. Next up, we have the case. Here's where we get a different landlord. This is a case of Franco versus Commissioner. Tax Court Summary Opinion 2018 number 9, issued on March 6th of 2018. This one looked actually at first glance to be far less likely to win. Mr. Franco was an architect, and he ran a small architectural business. He also had a fourplex. The fourplex was one that he used. You know, it was basically, he had a fourplex, and the fourplex, you know, that he did for renters. So the problem we would expect to have here is, number one, to get over the 1.5 hours, he's going to have to spend more hours at the rental, that single fourplex, than he did as an architect. And then secondly, he's also going to have to show these over 750 hours at the fourplex. It's like, look, it's a fourplex. It's got four renters in it. You know, how much time could you spend there? You might worry about that. Well, to get over the first hurdle, though, we discover he was not working full time as the architect. His records show he only had 109 hours of services for one customer, Wells Fargo's Trust Department, and he had another 540 hours doing work for a construction consulting company. So he only had 649 hours in the non-real property businesses during that year. That means that he just needs to show the 750 hours now. Now, that still seems difficult, right? How do you get 750 hours on a fourplex? Well, turns out he was able to do so. The court tells us that apparently, the tenants in the terms of the court were not very attentive to trash disposal matters. So he had to make weekly trips to make sure the trash bins were out, you know, for collection. He had to clean them if he needed. Then after the trash was picked up, he had to return them to their storage locations. He also did repairs at the property. He coordinated more substantial repairs with a handyman. You know, he communicated with the tenant. He collected and deposited rents, maintained insurance policies, purchased materials as needed, paid bills, and kept books and records for his accounting purposes. And he kept records of his time here. Two of the four tenants moved out during that year. That included additional time as they, you know, vacated the apartment, did extra repairs and maintenance. And also he'd been late paying property taxes and insurance premiums for the years. So he had to spend time negotiating a property tax installment plan and had to work with his mortgage lender to eliminate the redundant insurance companies on the property that being purchased when he hadn't paid for what he should have. So in this case, he had excellent records. And by the way, here's what's also interesting. Remember, in the prior case we had, you know, you went and looked at the supporting records and, you know, they were in different cities on days. Nothing made sense. In this case, if Mr. Franco, let's say, for instance, said he was performing repairs, well, guess what? They found receipts for purchasing materials that be used for that repairs on the days in question. They found supporting documents, other documents, receipts, other information that supported the fact he was doing it. They found phone records that supported calls in to do when he says he was doing work related to the property. In this case, all of the outside evidence supported his logs. His logs looked real. His logs were contemporary, and all the outside evidence supported it. Because of that, the tax court found that Mr. Franco was a real estate professional and was allowed to deduct his losses. Well, as we want to remind you, as always, this is brought to you by the State Societies of CPAs, because that's who I do a whole lot of continuing education lecturing for. And without that, we wouldn't be doing this. So I want you to be sure to take a look at what your state society is going to be offering in the coming year. Catalogs at different state societies will come about and become available online at different times. So, you know, be sure to check your state society's website for what's coming up. I realize right now you might be a little busy, but certainly right after April 15th, you can take a look and see what's going to be available for this coming year. As we all expect, lots of Tax Cuts and Jobs Act coursework is probably going to be coming up and be of interest to you. Be sure to take a look at what's going to be available and sign up for what you might need. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments again for the week of March 12th. I'm Ed Zollars. And I, you know, present this each week. You can catch the updates during the week at our website, currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. If you have any questions or comments, you can send them to me, edzollars@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. I post on Twitter when we do an update on the site, so you can find that at edzollars is my Twitter handle. You can also follow some discussions. I do tend to participate in the Reddit Tax Pro group. So at reddit.com/r/taxpros, you can find me there. Also on California Society's Tax Talk news group. So you know, if you want to pick up over there, you can find me that location. So hopefully you're having a good tax season. Hopefully you're able to keep up with what's going on. And we'll be taking a look at what's happening next week and hopefully be able to give you some new updates on what's been happening in the area of federal taxes.